This is Nightly Business Report with Tyler Matheson and Sue Herrera.
Business rift. The president's advisory councils, made up of influential CEOs, have been disbanded. What that could mean for the economy and the White House's pro-growth agenda.
Tough trade talk. Negotiations have started on a pact that connects the North American economy. And two industries in particular have an awful lot at stake.
Split decision. Federal Reserve policymakers are divided over interest rate hikes, leaving investors to navigate an uncertain path. Those stories and more tonight on Nightly Business Report for Wednesday, August 16th.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. A business backlash at the White House. For the past several days, we've been telling you about the CEOs who've decided to step down from the president's Manufacturing Advisory Council in the wake of the president's remarks on the deadly rally in Charlottesville. Well, today, the council has come to an abrupt end. Also disbanding is the president's separate strategy and policy forum, which was led by Blackstone's CEO Steve Schwarzman, and whose members included the CEO of Walmart, the nation's biggest employer, GM's chief, and the head of J.P. Morgan Chase. And all of this happened in dramatic fashion. Eamon Javers is following the story for us tonight from outside Trump Tower in New York City.
After the fireworks of the press conference here at Trump Tower yesterday, this morning began very calmly here at Trump Tower. This morning we saw a few members of the Trump family coming in and out, but no high-ranking members of the administration were spotted here at Trump Tower. Then, in the early afternoon, the first hint of what would become a deluge, the CEO of 3M saying that he was, in fact, leaving the president's advisory council. And after that, we got word that there was a conference call being held of an advisory council of elite CEOs led by Steven Schwarzman of Blackstone Group. Once that conference call got underway, we learned that, in fact, they had decided to disband that council. Moments later, we saw a tweet from the president of the United States saying, rather than putting pressure on the business people of the Manufacturing Council and Strategic and Policy Forum, I am ending both. Thank you all. The president there insinuating that it was his decision to end both of these councils, although we had had reporting that the CEOs on that conference call made the decision themselves before the president's tweet. Throughout the afternoon, we got additional statements from members of all of those CEO advisory councils distancing themselves from President Trump in one way or another, until we got the statement from Aetna's CEO that he was ashamed of the president's behavior, some of the toughest criticism from a CEO throughout the day. At the end of the day, the president left Trump Tower. He's headed to Bedminster, New Jersey, to his golf course there, and we'll see what tomorrow brings. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Eamon Javers at Trump Tower.
In just the past 2 weeks, the president has had two very public ruptures, one with the GOP leader in the Senate and now with top business figures. How enduring are these splits, and how much harder, if at all, do they make progress on the president's agenda? Jeff Bush is a partner at the Washington Update. Jeff, welcome. Good to have you with us. You know, it is easy on a day like this to say things like the president has lost business or his presidency is collapsing. But my question for you is whether the country and businesses beyond Manhattan, beyond the Beltway, and beyond the Fortune 500 see it this way. What do you think?
Well, I think that's great insight, and certainly there have been a lot of challenges with the president over the last several weeks. And I think once you get outside those Fortune 500 companies, I think there's still an appreciation for the long-term agenda of the Republican Party of lower taxation and lower regulation. And that's why I think there's going to be, while a disconnect here in the interim, I think in the long run, businesses will still support the Republican agenda.
So do you think that the president will be able to push that agenda through with Republicans on the Hill?
Well, the Republicans ran on the same platform as Donald Trump of lower regulation, lower taxation, and so forth. And so they know they'll be judged on that in the midterm 2018 elections. Therefore, they've got to get something going or they'll have to answer to the voters next November.
Does getting those things done, those agenda items, those platform items done, become how much more difficult do they become if the president becomes in some ways an untouchable or a pariah to some views?
Well, the president hasn't been overly hands-on with the legislative agenda thus far, so I'm not sure this changes that dynamic tremendously. The legislation starts within the legislative branch, and I think that will continue given the current agenda of the Republicans. I think the one exception to that would be the Affordable Care Act repeal and replace effort. The president and his administration wanted to put an additional effort on that here in September. I think that's where we could see a little diminished gravitas around the Hill and so forth in trying to push that Affordable Care Act repeal agenda.
Jeff, are you surprised that we haven't seen more volatility in the market as because of the headlines that have been coming out? Certainly we did see a little bit of a sell-off in the stock market, but then it came back. What's your read on that?
Well, interestingly, we have said since January of this year to anticipate an increase in volatility in the months of September and early October as it relates to the debt ceiling and the budget issue. The budget issue is the real issue. I think all these current ancillary things, including North Korea and the discussion, the press conference Donald Trump held earlier this week, those things amplify the increased volatility that we anticipate around those fiscal dialogues later this month.
All right, Jeff, thank you very much. Jeff Bush with the Washington Update tonight in Tulsa.
Thank you.
Also in Washington, the president's top trade advisor demanded major changes to the North American Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA. Robert Leisinger didn't mince words about the 23-year-old pact that the president has blamed for job losses to Mexico.
The views of the president about NAFTA, which I completely share, are well known. I want to be clear that he is not interested in a mere tweaking of a few provisions and a couple of updated chapters. We feel that NAFTA has fundamentally failed many, many Americans and needs major improvement.
As negotiations of that trade pact begin, we have two reports tonight on two industries that could be impacted by any changes. Aditi Roy reports on what's at stake for the agricultural sector, but we begin tonight with Phil LeBeau on the auto business.
Be honest, do you really know where your car or truck was built? Most people don't. And increasingly, they're coming from south of the border. This year, Mexico is expected to export more than 4 million autos, with the majority winding up sold in the U.S.
The NAFTA negotiations are pressured in all sorts of ways, but certainly having that growing footprint and growing capacity in Mexico is one of the pressures on the negotiators at the table.
The Trump administration wants more of what's sold in the U.S. to be built in the U.S., so it's likely to push for automakers to use more parts and components made in America or in the NAFTA region. Otherwise, they could be hit with a tax that could add hundreds of dollars to the cost of a vehicle. And despite the president threatening 35% tariffs on autos built in Mexico, most in the industry expect any changes in the trade deal to be less dramatic and take years to implement.
The automakers and the suppliers have timelines that go much longer than what we're looking at for the NAFTA renegotiation. Plus, once we know what's coming out of NAFTA, there's a period of time before things start to phase in.
So if you're looking to buy a new car or truck in the foreseeable future, these NAFTA talks will not change what you end up paying. But depending on what happens, in a couple of years, vehicles built in Mexico or Canada could come with a higher sticker price. Phil LeBeau, Nightly Business Report, Chicago.
Farmers are also watching the talks. Many have benefited from the trade deal, but they also have a wish list of improvements. Aditi Roy is in America's garlic capital, Gilroy, California.
Harvest season is in full gear at Usugi Farms in Gilroy, California. The bell peppers are shiny, red, and in perfect shape to go to vendors and ultimately customers' dinner tables.
Has it been a good season so far?
Yeah, so far so good. You know, production's been good, the markets have been good.
But in a few months, when these peppers aren't in season, Usugi Farms owner Pete Aiello says he relies heavily on farms in Mexico to supply him bell peppers so he can stay in business year-round.
There's a four-month window in there where we can't produce in California. It's too cold, the days aren't long enough. So it's a big part of our program.
As the Trump administration enters renegotiations with the Mexican and Canadian governments over NAFTA, some farmers, like Aiello, are anxiously awaiting the outcome. For Aiello, added tariffs on Mexican agricultural imports could, in the short run, affect up to a fifth of his revenues.
Doing business with Mexico is a very important part of doing business here in the United States. for producers like us. And that revenue all gets generated up here in the U.S. Everything gets imported, sold up here. It puts food on the tables for everybody up here.
The American Farm Bureau says Canada and Mexico are critical markets for U.S. agriculture. Since NAFTA was enacted, the organization says U.S. agricultural exports to those countries have risen more than 300% to about $38 billion last year, or about a third of total U.S. ag exports. The American Farm Bureau says that helps boost farm incomes, which have been cut in half since 2013 because of low prices.
We're looking at different opportunities to increase demand, but we certainly don't want to lose one of our most important markets and our important customers in Canada and Mexico.
Still, there are some items that are on farmers' wish list for NAFTA talks. Some poultry and dairy farmers want more access to Canadian markets. Some want less red tape to registering genetically modified crops. And they want a reduction in wait times at the border, which sometimes causes them to lose perishables.
It's the unknown that's worrying us.
But Aiello says he would just be happy if things stayed the same.
That would be the best case scenario.
If the talks result in higher tariffs or other protectionist measures, some trade groups warn that in the long run, consumers might have to shoulder the burden by paying higher prices for produce like this at the grocery store. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Aditi Roy, Gilroy, California.
The top GOP tax writer says Congress is forging ahead with the tax reform package. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady said members of Congress are making progress on one of the Republican Party's top priorities.
2017 is our year to deliver, to make history on tax reform. We're on that timetable. In fact, while we may not be in Washington, we are working. Our tax teams are meeting sometimes twice daily.
Congressman Brady added that the tax committee will update the White House on their progress soon.
Potential reforms out of Washington being watched very closely by the Federal Reserve. But according to the minutes of the last meeting, persistently low inflation is dividing policymakers at the central bank. Hampton Pearson has more.
There's a split among monetary policymakers over exactly when there should be another Fed interest rate hike. Monetary policymakers struggling to balance concerns about the decline in inflation with signs of a job market that continues to tighten. One faction expects inflation to be at or below the Fed's 2% target for the next 12 months, and they observe, quote, they can afford to be patient in deciding when to increase the Fed funds rate. The other set of policymakers, if you will, are concerned about pressure from a labor market that is already at full employment and could tighten further. The other piece of news from the Fed minutes, still no exact date as to when the Fed begins to plan the launch of reducing its $4.5 trillion bond portfolio. They decided instead to wait until the next meeting when they would have more information about overall economic conditions going forward. Although at that late July meeting, there were Fed members that wanted to announce a date certain for the beginning of the bond buyback program. Turning now to concerns about the overall economy and possible speed bumps, there is concern about the lack of action on fiscal policy, whether it's the Trump White House or Congress. Monetary policymakers are concerned about the lack of action on fiscal policy, trade, and health care. They say the inaction is slowing down spending and hiring in the private sector, which would help boost overall economic growth. But they remain largely positive about the overall economy, especially jobs and increased consumer spending. Next up for the Fed, the annual economic symposium next week in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The next meeting of the FOMC happens in late September. At the Fed, I'm Hampton Pearson for Nightly Business Report.
On Wall Street, stocks struggled to hold on to their gains after the release of those minutes of the last Fed meeting. Some strategists also say the tension surrounding the White House may be contributing to uncertainty in the market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 25 points to 22,024. The Nasdaq added 12, and the S&P 500 was up 3.5.
Still ahead, what Target did that most other retailers can't.
We'll be right back. Target's turnaround may be taking hold. The retailer was able to bring back shoppers to its stores in the most recent quarter, something that its rivals are having a hard time doing. Sales rose, profits beat expectations, and the company issued an upbeat outlook. That sent the stock higher. Courtney Reagan has more on this bright spot in retail.
Seismic shifts are happening in retail, and it's wrecking many retailers' sales and profits. But there are also retailers still surpassing expectations, even under pressure. And this quarter, Target is one of them. The big box retailer breaking its four-quarter losing streak for comparable sales, thanks to the highest store foot traffic in 2.5 years and online sales growth of more than 30%. While Target is now more confident about its sales and profit expectations for the rest of the year, it says it's still being prudent.
We have seen this from Target before, though, where we've seen quarters with good traffic and good e-commerce, and sometimes it hasn't been that consistent. So I think it's a step in the right direction, and I think they're doing a lot to improve their business, but I think we need to see a more sustainable improvement for us to feel better about the direction they're moving in.
Target paid a price for the quarter's stronger sales. It cost Target more to fulfill online orders, and it lowered prices to better compete. As a result, profits fell. While sales growth at the company was broad, grocery is still struggling to find growth, a problem because grocery is what gets customers into the store. The retailer has recently hired two new executives to help, one from General Mills and one from Walmart. As part of a three-year plan, Target is spending $7 billion to build new, smaller stores, remodel existing stores, improve its website and delivery speed, and add new brands. Earlier this week, Target bought Grand Junction, a technology transportation startup it hopes will help it deliver online orders more efficiently. So while Target exceeded expectations, it's not yet a trend, just one quarter. And the most important part of the year is still ahead. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Courtney Reagan.
Sales fell for the seventh consecutive quarter at Cisco Systems, and that's where we begin tonight's Market Focus. After the bell, the technology company said weaker performance in its switches and routers business was the reason behind the revenue slip. Those results still managed to top analysts' expectations, however. Earnings fell as well, but they matched estimates. Shares initially fell in the extended session, but they did finish the regular day up fractionally at $32.34. L Brands reported stronger than expected revenue after the bell, even as the parent of Victoria's Secret suffered lower sales due to its decision to no longer sell swimwear. Profit also was ahead of street targets, but the company cut its outlook for the full year and gave weak guidance for the current quarter. And that initially sent shares lower in the after-hours session. They did finish the regular day higher by 1% at $39.55. Urban Outfitters shares rose following the retailer's better-than-expected results after the bell yesterday. Same-store sales fell at the company's namesake and Anthropologie brands, but growth at Free People helped to offset those declines. Urban Outfitters said it is rolling out several initiatives it believes could lift those falling sales. Shares rose more than 17% to $19.76.
United Healthcare said its president, David Wichmann, would take on the role of CEO as the current chief executive transitions to the position of executive chairman. Shares fell fractionally to $193.77. And Kansas City Southern raised its quarterly dividend more than 8% to 36 cents a share. The yield on that stock is now more than 1%. The railroad operator, also replaced its current share buyback program with a new $800 million plan. Shares rose 1% to $107.49.
PayPal will bar users from accepting donations to promote hate and violence. This comes following revelations that the company played a key role in raising money for the white supremacist rally last weekend in Charlottesville. In a blog post, the company outlined its policy of not allowing its services to be used to advocate racist views.
Visa and MasterCard are coming under pressure to do the same. But other companies are popping up to take their place. Contessa Brewer takes a look at what some call the alt economy.
As the chaos in Charlottesville unfolded, the white supremacist website Daily Stormer found itself in the thick of the action. It had heavily promoted the rally, even offered rides on what they called the hate van, an alternative to Uber, which had refused service to white supremacists. Daily Stormer was promptly refused service from its web host, GoDaddy. Google followed suit. Now, Daily Stormer has moved to a Russian domain. As American companies move to distance themselves from white supremacists, they leave a void, increasingly being filled by clone alternatives. The alt-right is largely self-funded. Members of the movement donate to their favorite organizations. If GoFundMe won't host them, WeSearcher will. Many of the postings now ask for legal defense funds for white supremacists and neo-Nazis. Daily Stormer has raised more than $150,000 on this site alone. Supporters can pay with credit cards or bitcoins. PayPal's not an option at this point. Counter.fund will offer an intermediary wall between extremists and the credit card processors in PayPal. It even converts Bitcoin to cash, all for a hefty 20% fee, which is funneled in part back to the alt-right movement. Its founder, Pax Dickinson, told me, "We can't trust these companies because they're controlled by the left. We need to build our own systems, need to build a shadow economy. We can't rely on any of these companies." Dickinson pictures Counterfund as a grocery co-op with members buying from each other and job boards where applicants would have no fear of being fired for controversial views. When YouTube changed the way it compensates content creators, many artists, filmmakers, and journalists joined Patreon. But this summer, Patreon kicked off right-wing journalist Lauren Southern, sparking a backlash. Enter Patreon. It offers a platform to pay creators who push even the most extreme speech. As much as 15% of its revenue comes in Bitcoin to allow anonymity and cut out a middleman. Patreon's founder, Cody Wilson, insists he's not a white supremacist. He says he's simply committed to open discourse. He told me, "We're at a post-political moment where you can have all the opinions you want, as long as they're the right ones." Gab welcomes all opinions. It's a social media alternative to Twitter and Facebook, which have cracked down on hate speech. It's raised more than $500,000 in just 36 days and counting. With more than 200,000 users around the world, Gab is not only protecting dissent, but planning a new cryptocurrency to compete with Bitcoin, and even bigger plans to launch alt-economy businesses.
If PayPal's listening to this, hi, PayPal, we're going to replace you, PayPal, and we're going to replace you, Stripe, and we're going to replace the whole system, and we're also going to replace credit cards and all the little bank transaction fees these big banks taking. Gab is not about left or right. It's an economic populist movement.
And a movement that's making money and becoming more sophisticated all the time. Contessa Brewer, Nightly Business Report.
Coming up, is Apple using its massive cash pile to become a player in Hollywood?
Apple will take on Hollywood, and it is reportedly investing $1 billion to make sure it's a real competitor in the crowded market for original content. Julia Boorstin has more.
Apple has set a budget of about $1 billion to produce and license original content over the next year, according to the Wall Street Journal, expected to include those shows in a new video-focused offering that would launch in addition to Apple's $10 a month subscription app, Apple Music.
The billion-dollar number is a significant number, but in the grand scheme of Apple, it's pretty modest. Apple has $225 billion in revenue. They'll spend about $12 billion in R&D next year. And so this is a relatively small number for Apple, given its huge size.
So far, Apple's investment in original content has been limited and tied to Apple's core focus on music and apps, such as Carpool Karaoke and Planet of the Apps. That makes this push into the kind of scripted content like Game of Thrones that you'd find on HBO and Netflix a big departure.
Apple declines to comment, but it has hired some big-name Hollywood veterans here in Los Angeles, including Sony TV chiefs Jamie Ehrlich and Zach Van Amberg to run its video efforts, also tapping the former head of WGN America and Tribune Studios to head its development for original content.
If Apple invests $1 billion in content, that's still just about half what Time Warner's HBO spends annually, and about as much as Amazon spent in 2013, its first year investing in originals. Now Amazon reportedly spends about $4.5 billion, and Netflix will spend $6 billion this year.
This position of sort of starting later in the game is not unusual for Apple. Now, whether they will be ultimately successful or not remains to be seen. I mean, they certainly have the war chest to win. I mean, they have more cash than anyone else, and they generate more cash flow than anyone else.
Apple will not want to jeopardize its relationships with HBO and Netflix. Apple earns 30% of subscriptions obtained through the App Store for the first year, after which its take is 15%. One advantage Apple has as it becomes a frenemy to those media companies, Apple could immediately launch its exclusive content globally through the App Store's reach to 155 countries. For Nightly Business Report, I'm Julia Boorstin in Los Angeles.
And that is Nightly Business Report for tonight. I'm Sue Herrera. Thanks for joining us.
And thanks from me as well. I'm Tyler Matheson. We hope you have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow.